Coming up, it's Counterculture with Marie Buskey. A look into the world of critical social justice, woke culture, and more on RCR.
Reality Check Radio.
Are you someone doing amazing charitable work in the community? Or do you know of someone or some organization that is making an important difference in our communities? We want to highlight those individuals and charities and celebrate all they're doing. So if you have any suggestions, please send in your charity recommendations for the Community Gems segment of Simon O'Connor's show, Speak Free. You can email them to inbox@realitycheck.radio or text them to 2057. Thank you.
Good morning and welcome to Counterculture here on Reality Check Radio. I'm your host, Marie Buskey, and this is the place where we discuss the issues through a cultural lens and how ideologies are impacting our everyday lives. I've got a full show for you this morning. First, I catch up with Counterculture's lifestyle guru, Annie Hart. We've spoken about debt, dating, death, and today we look at diet, everyday practical advice for living a better, simpler life. Annie's advice is an ideal balm for my next topic, which is to look at the views and conversations I've had leading into the US elections next week. What happens in the US has a massive bearing on what has transpired both culturally and economically here in New Zealand, whether we like it or not. I've got clips from chats with Cam Slater, Trevor Loudon, Kevin Sorbo, Anne-Marie Waters, and James Fishback.
You're listening to Counterculture on RCR.
Reality Check Radio.
Welcome to Kiwi Farm. Established 1840. The farmyard was uncharacteristically quiet this week. Both Oinky Lunx and Winnie Ben were away on an island paradise, apparently on very important business, and many sheep were also lucky enough to tag along. This left a sense of calm of sorts back on Kiwi Farm. Or did it? After Darling Taker's ejection from the farmhouse the previous week to make way for a free ranger who identified as a unicorn to take her place, Chippy Pork had found that he'd been caught out lying. Was that disinformation? Or, as Chippy would consider it, mixing up his words about an operative working covertly behind closed doors? Thankfully, with Oinky and Winnie away, the sheep didn't dwell too much on his faux pas. They were easily enough redirected to a member of Oinky's sty who apparently got a little stroppy and may or may not have partaken in some fermented grape juice and was a little rude. However, the sheep were now focused on what was happening over on Uncle Sam's farm. Their election was imminent and the two contenders, Ronald Rump and Commie Lala, were feverishly hunting for their votes. You could not get two more diametrically opposed candidates. Ronald Rump, once revered by the sheep and kitty classes on Uncle Sam's, was now portrayed as the second coming of evil, and no expense or extremes were too much to prevent him ascending again to the top job. Commie Lala, on the other hand, smiled and cackled her way from event to event, highly orchestrated by those who Napoleon now sought comradeship with, and even the booing and heckling from her own supporters didn't seem to bother her a jot, which the sheep on Kiwi Farm thought made her appear even more presidential, when in fact she was simply in a stupor, tipsy from all the fermented beverages she was reportedly so fond of. This didn't matter one iota to the sheep of any persuasion. Those in Uncle Sam's likened Ronald to a dead dictator, and Commie Lala was all here to save you. The sheep on Kiwi Farm busied themselves with story after story of why Commie Lala was good for Kiwi Farm, how her largesse, no doubt influenced by Napoleon, was going to see the return of sanity to Kiwi Farm, and with Commie Lala at the helm of Uncle Sam's, Kiwi Farm would prosper. Up on the knoll, above the farmyard, where the chickens and other animals had grown tired of all the goings-on down below, they watched on. They'd stopped listening to the sheep years ago, preferring new networks of news that started sprouting up. Reality Chook Radio was a favourite on Kiwi Farm, but over on Uncle Sam's there was a bulldog called JR who had amassed a massive following, whom the sheep hated with a passion. But his followers simply did not care. JR would talk to anybody, any animal, any topic. He'd been doing it for years and commanded an audience that the sheep could only dream about. And now, sitting down across from JR this day for a chat, was Ronald Rump. The sheep on Sam's were incensed. How dare he ignore them? They bleated and berated Ronald Rump, a noise that became so deafening, but only if you resided in that echo chamber, of course. Back here on Kiwi Farm, upon the knoll, they were riveted at what they heard and saw. Could the years of madness be about to come to an end? Could this be the beginning of the second coming of the Rump? All will be revealed the following week when Uncle Sam went to the polls. Tune in next time to Kiwi Farm for the latest developments exclusively here with Counterculture on Reality Check Radio.
This is Counterculture with Marie Buskey, Wednesdays at 10 a.m. on Reality Check Radio.
Good morning and welcome back to Counterculture here on Reality Check Radio. And it's been a hot month or two or three since I've had the Annie Hart on the show, my lifestyle guru. How are you, Annie?
I'm good.
It's been too long. It's been far too long.
Far too long.
We did catch up in Reelsies though in August, so that was fun.
We did.
So that was very good. And we've done death, we've done debt. We've done dating, and it's now time to do diet. But as we were just saying before we got started, it's not really diet. We just wanted to talk about living. I don't know whether you've seen this in recent weeks, but there's certainly been an awareness and awakening in the United States around the quality of what you eat, how you live, as well as the involvement of Big Pharma that many of us have been aware of, but the involvement of big food companies in controlling what you consume, how sedentary people's lives have become, and the Means siblings, Kelly and Casey Means, have been getting a lot of airtime around the work that they've been doing. She's a doctor and he, I think, is a lobbyist, a former lobbyist for some of these groups. They've been on Tucker and Rogan and all the rest. But sometimes that all is out there in the ether, isn't it? You can't touch it. And you think, oh, well, how do we dissect and distill that down to me?
We need to get it practical.
How do we do that, Annie?
Well, I think really, well, first of all, just probably people don't know much about why am I telling them these things? Health is my passion and my training, and I can reveal that I've been in health for over 30 years doing, well, I was a physiotherapist actually, but what I've done a lot is a lot of health coaching. And what I found is everybody starts from a different place. So you've got to find out where people are starting from and walk beside them to get them to where they want to go. And some people want to go very fast and other people want to go very slow. And what I find is that when people come to me and they're prepared for health coaching, they're ready because they've had a fright or revelation. Maybe they've heard something on RCR. Maybe they've listened to the good interviews with Health Hacks, particularly with Glenn Davies. He's been talking a lot about being low carb, which, of course, is the way to go. For health, there's lots and lots of health benefits, and you've only got to go back to many RCR interviews to find those interviews. So that's really cool. But yes, so somebody's in a situation where they think I really need to do something and they don't know where to start. Sometimes it's helpful to talk to someone like me, but if you're like me, maybe you can take stock with your own notebook and write a list of things that you would like to change. Maybe that's something that you can do. Then if you're stuck on the how-tos, that's when a coach comes in. But essentially what we're looking at is our whole life. We're looking at sleep. We're looking at hydration. We're looking at relationships, mental health, food. Food is very, very key. And with food comes supplement or not to supplement. Is my food enough or not? And that the answer is usually no. But the idea is to get everything you can from your food. So, for example, eating things like liver, if you're a meat eater, is really, really helpful to your health. Eating some fresh greens, for some people, there are certain greens you can't eat, but eating fresh greens, say a really healthy homegrown lettuce salad, might be the turning point you need is to grow your own lettuce in your garden. Could be that simple. Might be that you just need to take the dog for a walk every morning for your mental health and for your physical health. Could be, or it could be huge. It could be a complete lifestyle change.
Yeah. So it is often that starting point. One of the things I know, because, you know, we're all ladies of a certain age, and for me, the menopause, it's not been a fright, but it has certainly been a transition.
It is.
And, you know, it's so funny. You're a mum as well. And you know how when we have our children, there used to be the lies that no one actually told you. Like, you'd have these babies and it's like, this wasn't an antenatal and I didn't see this in a book. My mother didn't say anything about that.
Yeah.
And I've realized now that it's like this Machiavellian game that women play, that we don't tell ourselves these things because no one would ever do it. And menopause is a bit the same. It's a, no two menopauses are the same, I've discovered.
That's true.
Talking to my girlfriend and feeling and seeing your body change on you again, for me, has been a bit of a mission. And I know I've had to make changes. Some of them are subtle, some of them are more dramatic, as I've gone through that change. And it, oh man, it is certainly, you do feel better, but if I can see how women can get really bogged down with menopause and want to sort of instantly go to a medicinal fix.
That's right.
I'm trying to do it without having to go to the patch any. I'm working hard to stay off the patch because.
Well, it's funny, I'm in the same place.
So how have you coped with it? What have you done?
Well, okay. So this is the thing. I've done, myself and members of my family have done a lot of research about health and supplementation. And actually, one person that's really helpful is actually my son. He spends a lot of time on a computer and he's always looking for solutions for his own life and for ours. So I'll say, can you look up such and such? And off he goes and looks it up and we discover something new together. So I find listening to information, trying stuff out, honestly, it's been, you know, I've tried some things. For example, when I was younger, I thought that the healthiest thing I could do was to become a vegetarian. And so at 19, when I was already fit and actually starting to do triathlons, I became a vegetarian. And that worked for me for 16 years in that I was young and relatively healthy to start with. But what happened is I started to become obese. Slowly, slowly, once I had children, I had my first child as a vegetarian. And basically what I was doing, when I think about it now, was carb loading. I was eating a lot of carbs, a lot of nut loaves that had a lot of carbs in them. But what I had done is I'd gotten off the standard American junk food diet and I'd gotten into organics. And so every ingredient was organic. But it just happened that I wasn't eating any animal at all. And I know that there are people out there that are vegetarians and they might be going, well, I think vegetarianism is the right thing to do for me. How do I eat more healthy? Well, it will be harder. And if you're a vegan out there, you know, I wouldn't recommend it. Personally, if you want coaching, you're going to have to go to a very high-level vegan coach. I would not coach somebody who was a vegan because I would feel that I don't have all the tools. So, yeah, it's hard to get your fats and oils, and despite what many people say, it's very hard to get quality protein. And there's quite a few essential nutrients missing from a vegan diet. So for me, I have actually been a vegan. I've been gluten-free. I've been dairy-free. I have been a vegetarian for 16 years, which I look back on, and if I knew what I knew now, I would not have done. I think it actually did some damage to my body. I have been carnivore. I was carnivore a few years ago for 6 months. And again, it's quite radical for a lot of people, but it is actually the ultimate elimination diet because all of the things that can make most people sick or trigger different things in their body are taken away on a carnivore diet. So for some people, that would be the way to go, but I would not do it without some advice and help just because it's so different for people. Yes, I've experimented a lot. I've made a lot of mistakes, and I've also been to various health practitioners with different testing modalities, blood tests, hair tests, all of that stuff, which have all been talked about on RCR. And I wish in a way that I had had a guide. I had several different gurus and mentors, but each of those people were kind of pushing a barrow that might have led to some sales, and some of those things were helpful. You know, I'm taking supplements now that I've heard about on RCR, and that person will be gaining from that, but I feel like they are good supplements, so that's why I'm taking them. Mm-hmm. Now, I like to, if something's working well for me, sometimes I stop doing that thing and see if anything changes when I don't do it. So I'm very, very experimental and have done that since I was 19.
Well, because I guess that makes sense, doesn't it, Annie? Because our bodies are the most complex system, network and computer,
yep,
an organic form that is on the, yep, planet. No two bodies are the same. So no, you can't apply a one-size-fits-all program to every single person. So I guess that comes back down to the individual, what your goals are, and how is it that I achieve that goal, as you said before, either fast, mm, or slow. So,
that's right.
Yeah. So let's look at some of the key things. So some of those frights that you talked, yep, about before, because let's, yep, face it, middle age, that's where we tend to get some of those frights.
Looking in the mirror can be frightening.
Oh, yes. One of the ones I know the means talked about, and particularly in the United States with the ultra high processed foods that they have, type 2 or pre-diabetes is a massive one at the moment. Mm-hmm. The new wunderkind drug seems to be Ozempic. Funnily enough, they reckon you can jab your way back to happiness and thinness with that. Oh, gosh, you would have thought they'd learnt first time round. Anywho, yes, you would. So let's look at pre-diabetes. That is often a harbinger of saying, right, body's saying, look, team.
Yes.
We need to get in check here.
Well, if you have pre-diabetes, which I would hazard a guess that many New Zealanders would have without knowing about, likely, not always, but likely you would have put on some weight. And maybe, like myself, you might have struggled with weight your whole life. So pre-diabetes doesn't just happen. It's taken years to get to that point. And it's years and years of accumulated habits. So if somebody came to me and they were concerned about the fact that they had pre-diabetes or, you know, their blood sugars were starting to change, I would straight away look at diet. And what I do for that is I don't necessarily need people to write a whole week of what they eat. If we just go through, one of my skills is asking good questions. And so we would go through and say, right, tell me what is the first thing you put into your body in the morning or whenever you put that in, and what time that is. And we just walk right through the day. What's typical? Oh, this is lunchtime for you. Is that a typical lunch? Or are there two or three different? No, I typically have, you know, a wrap, okay? And what do you have in the wrap? Great. And then we go all the way through the day, and we go right through to bedtime, and we look at the timing of the food, and we look at what the food is. And drink, any drink, whether it's alcohol, whether it's coffee, if it's juice, green smoothies, all that sort of stuff. And I can immediately personally see some hot spots. So one of the things that concern me is that somebody that is trying to be on a health kick, particularly as a woman, latch on to, and I'm sorry, people that believe in this, green smoothies. Green smoothies can be the absolute worst because of the ingredients in them. And well, there's two reasons. One is that you may not be chewing, you're just swallowing. If it's real food, I would prefer people can actually chew it. Secondly, people go, oh, I start my day with a green smoothie. What's in your green smoothie? Well, the orange juice and the spinach and yogurt. Now, orange juice and yogurt are very high carb. And so you're straight away spiking your blood sugar. So if somebody said to me, well, what can I change it with? I say, do you like eggs? Yes, I love eggs. Right, scrambled eggs in the morning. Done. That might be the only change that person needs to make. They might have a healthy lunch and a healthy dinner, but they've started their day with a green smoothie and a coffee, and that might have just kicked up their blood sugar. Now, of course, I'm not a doctor, and I do recommend that people, if they have a medical condition, that they're under the supervision of that medical person. However, we do have our own minds, and you can be under your own supervision. You can take notes, you can do your own pulse, you can do, well, it's a bit harder to do blood pressure, but you can do finger pricks to look at your own blood sugar if that's already become a diagnostic issue. And I believe that type 2 diabetes, for the vast majority of people, whether you are fatty or skinny or somewhere in between, can be turned around adequately so that you would not need to be medicated. I've seen it time and time again. And I think that Glenn from Reversal would say, and many others would say exactly the same thing. Really easy to turn around. So where people fall over is, oh, but I love my dot, dot, dot. So what we do is put enough food into the system that that person is not going to be hungry. And if they have a particular addiction, we look at swapping. Lollies are one. A lot of people eat lollies late at night. Do you know of anybody that does that? I mean, that's a thing. Some people, they say to me, I just have to have my toast. Well, no, you don't. But you think you do. And is it the crunch? Is it the mouthfeel? So we look at what that is for people. And then we look at something that's equally as yummy and satisfying for them. So it could be, for example, we do most things from scratch. We've got, you know, dried everything and homemade salami and stuff like that. So it might be that the person eats a slice of salami instead of some toast. Or they might have, you know, they might have another egg with avocado. But we find out what they do like and we put the do likes in. And if there's not enough taste yum yum for them, we look at helping people to learn how to make things like pestos or aiolis or even short term hummus is not low carb, but it's a good in between transition. If someone's snacking on, you know, really horrible junk, like they're eating chippies every day or corn chips, nachos is a big one. People think nachos are healthy. Well, parts of the nachos are. If you're someone that can manage carbs, they're not a problem. But if you can't manage carbs, you need to keep away from them. Mm-hmm. So it's just, you know, learning how to, if you go out to a restaurant and I go out and I often get Eggs Benedict, but I never get the toast. I just say, can I have extra bacon, please? And some people give it to me and other people don't. So that's what I do. So it's just a way of getting rid of those things that are dead weight. Unfortunately, bread, rice, potatoes, pasta, those carbs are the things that people need to get rid of, and they can be very addicted to them because they're sugars. They turn into sugars. Can we just find other things for them to love? It's just a matter of where are the healthy things in my diet and where are the unhealthy things. And some people will get a shock. They'll think that something's healthy. Like if you've got pre-diabetes and you are loving your porridge for breakfast, there's nothing wrong with porridge for breakfast, particularly for a young person or a young growing male. But I would say that if you love your porridge for breakfast with plenty of milk and a lot of honey on top, and I look at the diet and it's the worst thing in the day in terms of carb loading, I would take that out and replace it with, you know, a protein shake, bacon and eggs, you know, something that's high in protein and reasonably high in fat. Yeah. So it's just a matter of trawling through it together, really.
Well, and isn't it interesting what you've just stated? I mean, remember the food pyramid that we used to get taught? One of the things that I discovered is that pyramid was developed by corporate interests. I mean, it was developed by a lobby group.
To get us addicted into grains.
To grains and those foods. So it's like turning that food pyramid on its head. One of the things we're quite hot on in this house is seed oils. Yes. Not fond of the seed oils here.
No, we don't have seed oils either.
We have been very much a bring back butter house.
Yes.
And you know, extra virgin olive oil and coconut oil are ones that we use here. And it's amazing. Like because I love to cook. I do a lot of cooking.
Yep.
And for me, when giving up the seed oils, it was how do I have an oil that has got a high smoke point because of the type of cooking that I'm doing. If I'm doing stir frying with vegetables or meats, do a lot of Asian cooking. And that's where, for me, coconut oil was an absolute discovery because it's flavourless, colourless, odourless, and has a high smoke point.
That's right.
I was like, where have you been hiding all my life?
Yes, well, I think coconut oil is quite a good, gosh, what's the word when you stop taking a drug and you take something that's not quite so bad? What's the word for that?
Gateway transition.
It's a gateway. I believe that coconut oil is a gateway. Now, coconut oil is not unhealthy. It is healthy. But there is something better, and that's tallow. I am a great, great fan of tallow. I put it everywhere on my body. I make all my own balms and deodorants and face creams and healing balms and everything. And it used to be all with when I was a vegetarian and doing herbal stuff, it was always coconut oil. Now it is always tallow, and yes, there is room in somebody's diet for coconut oil, particularly if they're not a meat eater and they just can't stand the idea. But the nutritional properties in animal fat are incredible, particularly with fish. If you were going to choose something, if you were thinking, oh, I don't really want to eat meat, but I'll eat some flesh, that would be oily fish. You know, we need those fish, and from the best source you can get them. So again, if you love fish and you think, oh, it's really expensive, ditch some of your bad habits and put the money into fish, or go fishing if you can, or have access to someone. The seed oils, you just don't, they shouldn't be in the supermarket. They are very, very bad for people, the way that they've been produced and their nutritional value and their level, their ability to create toxins in the body. So yeah, butter is amazing, and coconut oil is pretty good. And olive oil, please, please don't cook it. If you are going to put something in the pan, do not waste your beautiful olive oil. Use it for salads.
Salad dressings.
Salad dressings, drizzle it on top. Yeah. You know, if you need something wet and oily and you've got food sitting there, use your olive oil.
And the other thing too, mayonnaise, you mentioned before, a lot of people, yeah, and aioli. A lot of people love those, but they don't, they always will go to the supermarket to buy it, and they don't actually realize how straightforward this is to make yourself.
I think we'll do a recipe.
Yeah, with good quality ingredients. Yeah, you tell me yours and I'll tell you mine.
Okay. So I put an egg in my blender. It's a beautiful egg from someone I swapped with meat with. Beautiful egg in the blender, and I shove some, and I literally mean shove, depending on my mood, a mixture of salt, garlic. I might put mustard in, I might not put mustard. So if I'm doing something simple, it'll just be salt and garlic. And then I blend it, and as it's blending, this is the important part. You don't want to be in a warm room, like a not a hot room. You get your beautiful olive oil and you start to drizzle it in the top. And what will happen as you blend it is it will slowly thicken up. Now, if you put, you know, say half a cup in and you've blended it and it hasn't thickened up, you might need to cool your olive oil a bit and take your blender into a cooler room and just start again, take it all out and start again, because sometimes it doesn't thicken. It's called emulsification. But I might add, I don't normally add a lot because it's going on a salad anyway. I might add pepper. I might add turmeric. I might put extra garlic in, but I don't always put mustard in. It just depends on my mood, but it should taste. Oh, sorry. And then the last thing I put in is a squeeze of lemon juice, just a squeeze. So it should taste reasonably salty and quite lemony. And I like the garlic to be almost overpowering because our family love garlic. So it depends. Yep. And then you've got aioli. It'll be about a cup's worth. And, you know, I don't measure things. I just sort of add in. For each egg, I would probably triple the amount of oil that goes in. And then I store it in the fridge, and we use it very generously on top of salads, roast vegetables, and even sometimes on meats. Yum, yum. It's just the glue that makes everything yummy.
Yeah, our one is fairly similar, so it's egg as well. Egg, I tend to use apple cider vinegar instead of lemon. Yep, so apple cider vinegar. So it's usually one egg, about two tablespoons of apple cider vinegar, about a teaspoon of salt, pepper if you want, but I tend not to do pepper. And then that's just it. And then I will whack the blender on and just sort of mix that up first, and then do the same. Pop the blender on and then just slowly add. Now look, if you're all sitting there thinking, Marie, we don't have a freaking blender, or we've got a ninja that doesn't add stuff in the top or what have you, you can actually do this with a bowl and a whisk. You'll get very, very good bicep muscles doing this.
Or you could fork it and use your arm even more.
Yeah.
You know, if you're stuck in your batch without a whisk.
And you literally just very, very slowly add the oil. And from memory, the oil, it's about a cup and a half, thereabouts.
It's a lot more than the egg.
Yeah, it's about a cup and a half of the oil. And you just ever so slowly whisk that in, and it just gets creamier and creamier and creamier and creamier.
And I stop mine and taste it, and then I go, oh, it's still quite salty. I'll add some more oil. So if in doubt, add less and add more in. And you don't use garlic. You can use garlic. You don't have to use garlic. You can put whatever you like in it, but I would say keep it simple. It's got a taste of its own, and then you can put it over your food. The other thing I find helps a lot of people to get sort of a yummy stuff. They go, what about this? What about that? Because people miss, I think, the creamy, tasty mouthfeel of deep fried stuff or pasta with a sort of oily sauce. They miss that. So I use a lot of pesto just because you can make pesto out of any green in your garden. I use parsley a lot. If I don't have parsley, is very, very good for you. If I don't have basil, I grow basil every year, but sometimes I just grab weeds out of the garden that are edible weeds and blend them into a pesto, because I have a family member that can't eat greens because they have a high level of disability. And what I find is pesto is a great base, again, for a quick eggy meal, or quite often we do a lot of leftovers. So I'll grab pesto, shove it in the pan, chop up some of yesterday's roast, put a little bit of gravy in. I mean, this sounds disgusting, but it's actually delicious. A chopped up onion. And then we might look at it and go, that looks a bit sloppy. Let's shove some eggs in, shove a couple of eggs in. And we've got a soft, forkable, quick, high-protein meal. That's, you know, my husband goes, quick, it's lunchtime. And I go, oh, no, I haven't cooked. Oh, we've got some leftover meat. That's what I do. So you can make a sort of a goo. I have met people that don't eat leftovers. Well, they need to get over themselves, because they're food in your fridge. But you can put your favourite things in. You can put celery in. You can put grated carrot in if you want to. You know, if you want a higher vegetable content than that. Whereas, because we've walked the carnivore journey, I'm not trying to, excuse my pun, beef up all of my meals with a ton of different vegetables. There's key vegetables we use, but not the range I used to.
It's interesting you talk about the pesto, because you look at... when you look at traditional diets, and they talk about the traditional Mediterranean diet, and there's two diets that stand out. One is traditional Mediterranean, the other one is Japanese, mm-hmm. that both have got very good longevity properties. One of the things that they use a lot, depending on where you are, is some form of fresh green-based sauce. So mm-hmm. you've got pesto with the Italians, salsa verde with the French, you've got chimichurri with the South Americans, you know, and all it literally is, nine times out of ten, is an olive oil, some form of green herb, and generally lemon. Sometimes with or without nuts, with or without cheese, with or without anchovies.
Mm.
But it's some sort of very simple green or zesty condiment that is made by simple ingredients.
And it's wet and it's oily and it sort of helps any dry ingredients to have that yum factor. I'll tell you, we had an Italian woofer some years ago and I'd made pesto and she was right into her Italian food. And she said, that is better pesto than my mother makes. I said, you're joking. She goes, it is. And I said, well, it's probably cheaper too, because I don't use pine nuts because they're hugely expensive. But I can just run through what I put in my pesto. I mean,
oh, go on then. Go on. What are you?
So you go outside and you walk around barefoot in your garden. That's really important. And you smell the roses. If you do not have your own herbs or vegetables in your garden, consider getting a very small amount. The things that I really value, because they're easy, are parsley and basil in my pesto. But I can put any green edible leaf in. I wouldn't eat spinach, but that's another story. And then I come home and I wash them and sort of shake them so that there's not too much water and dice them up. I've got a blender. You could use a stick blender. It would be a bit messier, but I've got a standard blender. I put it in and then I chuck in literally about half a cup of, what do we call them? Sunflower seeds instead of pine nuts.
You use sunflower.
Sunflower seeds. I do not use parmesan because a lot of people are dairy free and it's expensive. So I'm trying to keep it cheap and yummy. I put in the best quality olive oil I can afford. So I get decanted stuff locally if I can, try and support local olive oil. And I put in a ton of salt and I put in a heap of garlic. And I blend it, and I let it blend, and I scrape the sides down, and I might taste it again. I might have noticed I've put too much salt in, so I put some more parsley or whatever in. But I just do it to taste. It is hard to get the nuts to actually, they don't completely grind up. They sort of cut up. But when you eat them and put them in your mouth, when you put a teaspoon of pesto in your mouth, it's very tasty, highly garlicky and slightly salty. And, I mean, you could chuck in other vegetables, but I keep it green. Because, you know, we can add it to all sorts of things, but you could put other things in as well. Simple.
My grandmother was Māori, and she was, if she'd go places, and I remember she came and visited here once, it was not long after we moved in, and anyway, we had puha, just some wild puha that just happened self-seeded, and I'd sort of seen it, and I hadn't you know, hadn't clocked it really when she walked in and she saw this pooha sitting there, and she, next minute, she's out and she's got a little paper bag and she's picking the pooha. Yeah. And I'm like, you know, what are you up to, La? Oh, you haven't picked your pooha. And it's like, oh, I didn't even realize it was there. And I completely forgot about that, because that's a bitter green pooha. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it's one that often people associate with a boil up, but pooha actually eaten as a fresh green vegetable in a pesto would actually be quite good. Yeah. And bitter greens are very good for your liver, I understand.
Now, the only thing I would say with caution, and again, I do not know, and I will find out about pooha, is whether it's high in oxalates, because that's my beef against spinach. Is spinach is very, very high in oxalates. And I am somebody, again, this is my own experience, who's had very sore joints. And I spent, the vegetarianism didn't help, to be honest, but because I had a lot of spinach. But I went, when I did my carnivore phase, which was 6 months, I did a deep dive into oxalates, which cause crystals in your joints. And some people are far more susceptible. And the highest oxalates in spinach. Now, there are oxalates in other things, and this is not going to be a lesson on oxalates, but I wonder about pooha, and that would be something that would be worth finding out.
Do oxalates also exacerbate gout?
Yes, absolutely.
Right.
Yes.
Okay.
So, as women, and okay, there's men out there too, hello men, as women of a certain age, once we hit menopause, my experience is all my chickens came home to roost. There was all these things I found out about myself. For example, I have got Hashimoto's thyroiditis, which is another thing that has pushed me into being much more strict with my very low-carb diet. Now, I am not keto. I'm very close, and that's where I'm trying to get. But I have done a lot of intermittent fasting, and I did all these things as I got to this age because, A, I had reached menopause. I was putting on more weight. I was feeling more tired, and I had a thyroid problem. But I got sore joints. So everything came because, you know, as you change, it all comes out in the wash, doesn't it? And so one of the things I discovered was oxalates are not making my joints happy. And oxalates are found in quite a few different things. Look it up. It's worth going down that rabbit hole again.
So what are some of the key offenders on the oxalate path? I'm thinking tomatoes could be there, nightshades.
Beets, nightshades, and spinach. Spinach is the absolute worst and plays havoc with a lot of people because of the Green Smoothie Brigade. That's a key thing that people put into their smoothies. Not everybody does, but people feel more virtuous the greener their smoothie is, I think. Sorry if I've offended you. It's really the worst thing to put in your body. Yeah, yeah. There's not many smoothies I would approve of. They'd have to be whey based, and they would have to have vegetables that weren't high in sugar, which most vegetables are.
I remember many years ago, because I mean, you've met me in person, and I'm A, very tall. And actually, if anyone's ever been to an RCR thing, a lot of the women in RCR were all very tall.
Jaspreet's really tall. Yeah, I remember when I first met Jaspreet, I could not believe how tall she was.
Yeah, I mean, I'm actually one of the shorter ones. I'm 5'10". I'm one of the shorter ones. A lot of the women are sort of between 5'10 and 6 foot.
So,
Clara's our exception.
I always thought Alia was short.
No, Alia's taller than me.
Until I met them. Very funny.
Yeah, so you see
them on a video and their face is sitting down.
Hey, you wait until you meet Katie Ashley Coppins.
Yes, I have. She's
at least 6 foot. So a lot of us are very, very, very tall.
Yeah.
But I'm definitely of the hefty Polynesian persuasion. So I've always sort of been a bit bigger. But it's interesting, you mentioned firstly fasting. Like for me, when my menopause started, I actually discovered that I was better off to actually fast in the morning, just some water and simple tea or simple coffee without milk, you know, just for a phase, and then have something lighter at lunchtime and then my healthier dinner. And that actually for me was a huge change. I slept better. Mm-hmm. I had the aching and the paining disappeared. I was like, wow, okay, that's a simple change I can deal with. So that for me worked very well.
Wow, that's cool.
But it's that finding what works for you, isn't it? That figuring out what does work for you and what has you feeling better. And for me, it is, and I guess, you know, women of a certain age, for me, it is sleep.
Yeah.
Sleep is one that I find, if I'm not sleeping properly, that I need to look at what's going on, and we can look at the stress, but often I need to be looking at the diet as well. So what are some of the key factors with sleep that you come across?
Okay, so sleep is, I seem to be the worst, well, the best maybe, advocate for things, because sleep is something that I have always battled with my whole life, right? And it's gotten worse. I have a relative that I look after that is basically in the last stages of their life, and that's been going on for quite some time, so that's been really stressful. There's several things. One is shortening your eating window from a diet perspective, and I have to admit that, again, I haven't quite gotten there, but ideally, once you've, like, don't take this on. If you are somebody who is addicted to food and you're feeling out of control with food, don't do this first. Get rid of the junk first. You know, there's ways and means. But this would be the next step, once you've got your food cleaned up, is to shorten your window to maybe an 8-hour eating window. And for me personally, I need to make sure, and so does everybody, is that you don't eat within 2 to 3 hours of going to bed. So if I go to bed at 10 o'clock, I should probably finish eating by 6 o'clock or even 6:30. But it depends on when I start eating. And as people get down the track, there are some people that need to eat breakfast, particularly while they're changing to a healthy diet. But then often the first meal that people remove is they might not eat their first meal until lunchtime. So they've shortened that window. It depends on how you do it. Sometimes it's evening, sometimes it's morning, sometimes it's both. But if you became, say, a carnivore or very low carb, you might find that you're ending up with eating two meals a day, or even some carnivores and some people eat one meal a day. And that's in line with our natural bodies in nature. We don't actually snack all day. That is not something that humans are naturally going to do. And in the past, you know, going back to our ancestral diet, we might have eaten an animal and binged on it for 2 or 3 days, and then we might not eat for 3 or 4 days. So I'm not suggesting people do that, but to shorten that window. The other thing about sleep is sleep hygiene, and the biggest offender for me and for everybody I've ever met is devices, getting off those devices. And, you know, I have sat in the evening knitting many evenings. I want to get my knitting in before bed, and I get really angry if I don't get 30 minutes of knitting. It pisses me off, excuse my language. But I used to watch a political thing. I used to listen to RCR or watch a Tucker Carlson or something else I was trying to catch up on in the COVID days. Or, you know, back in those frantic days, I was actually, you know, working and doing stuff. So what I've done now is I turn off music and I turn off the internet and I turn off the interesting documentary or whatever it is at 8:30. Very, very hard one for me. But I find that calms me down, and I try and do, I've got several lots of knitting. I do the knitting that is least stressful. So it could be reading a book. I used to do that in bed before I slept, but I have a husband that doesn't like the light on. So some people read a book. Some people meditate before bed, and some people might do a little bit of yoga, but you need to get off the devices, off, out of work mode. You know, you might have, if you've got TVs blasting in your house, well, you might have a new sort of rule that if people are going to be watching that sort of stuff, they have to do it quietly. Get rid of all that noise and turn the lights down. Even on your devices, I've got mine from 5 o'clock going orange. So even at 5 o'clock, my devices are going orange and telling me it's getting, we're quietening down. Mm-hmm. So then the habit attached to that would be to get up early in the morning and do that stuff in the morning. You know, get busy in the morning. And then once you've hit mid-afternoon, start to slow down.
Yeah.
Don't have a coffee in the afternoon. I've done that too. I've often done a 4 o'clock coffee, and I've stopped doing that, so that's a thing. And also, some of us don't do well on caffeine. I love having a rooibos chai in the afternoon if I want to drink a hot drink with cream in it, because cream is good for you. So yeah, that would be the sleep thing. The other thing is make sure that you don't have a hot room, that you've got a cool room for sleeping at night, and that you can shut all your curtains and you don't have your devices or flashing alarm clocks, everything goes quiet. And you could even go to the extent of getting the blue light glasses for use on your computer in the later half of the day. Now, I had a lovely NZD SOS doctor help me with some of the sleep hygiene stuff. And, you know, I knew it all, but I wasn't doing it.
Yeah.
And that's the thing. Drink plenty of water too. And stimulants, any stimulant. I hadn't thought about that. If you're a Coca-Cola drinker or something, get rid of it out of your life. If you are an energy drink drinker, drink them only in the morning. Mm. Ideally, you'd get those out of your life as well. That's where you claim your money back. You can buy good food when you stop drinking and eating the junk.
Well, they're expensive, isn't it? And it's just setting sort of good habits and boundaries. So everyone's listened to all of this now this morning and they're like, oh gosh, you know, I think a lot of it is deep down we know. So give me three simple things that if people are sitting at home listening to this that you could do, which easy, quick, inexpensive, that will give you some really nice results to get you started on this journey.
Eat more meat and eggs. So maybe swap out some of the other stuff. When you go to the supermarket, have a look at your shopping cart and look at the rice, the pasta, the bread and all of those things and start to get less of those in your shopping cart and put more meat, eggs and vegetables in your shopping cart. More things that were previously walking, swimming, running or what was it, growing out of your garden. The third thing, and to really, this is probably not quick, but if you don't have a garden, start to grow some simple, maybe some lettuce, maybe some parsley, something really simple. You can container garden. I've seen people grow their whole household needs in container gardens. You can just use a shitty old bucket. It does not have to be expensive. And if you don't know how to do it, get some of your RCR, VFF friends to help you out. I think growing food helps you appreciate it. Even if it's just, wow, I've got fresh lettuce, I've got some fresh parsley, whatever it is, I often, you know, pull a carrot straight out of the garden and I'm sorry, I don't wash it. I just eat it because I want to eat the dirt as well. I mean, I'm not, that's not my advice to you. That's just, I get enthusiastic about pulling things out of a garden and eating them. Really exciting. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I think start looking at your shopping trolley and you could even take, if you think you're making changes, take a photo of your shopping trolley. That might be something that you can do because I don't want anybody to feel shame. If you feel that it's overwhelming, then get help. I offer help. Other people offer help. But coaching, it's like going to a counsellor. It's sometimes worth laying it out to someone and going, I don't know where to start, because I can always find a starting point for people. If somebody has, like if they write down everything that they eat in a day, we might change one thing. Might be a breakfast, might be taking out two coffees. It might be getting rid of soft drink, just one thing at a time. I think for some people it's overwhelming to make change without some guidance, and for others, people do their own study and just race ahead. So whatever you need is okay.
Mm. And also to getting support on the journey as well. I love your idea about the VFF garden groups. I know they exist. My mother-in-law is in one.
Yes.
She loves it. She Lovely. Absolutely loves it. It's one of the highlights of her week is going to a gardening group. And that's just it. It's getting that camaraderie. And if you've actually got like-minded people and you do it on a journey, you might have somebody you're friends with a garden. Someone else might have access to eggs, or someone out, as you said before, might be a fisher person or a fisherman and might, you know, you get the whole, I love a barter. Bartering
Swap
is my.
Swapsies are great.
Swapsies is the best thing
we need to really develop our swapsies muscle and our spending cash with each other muscle. And not just automatically go to the supermarket.
Mm. Yeah, well, it's how our parents and grandparents did it.
They did.
Absolutely. My grand, both, oh gosh, gardening is, my father has now, so funny, my parents have just moved into retirement community. I think you and I have talked about this on some of our previous episodes. And anyway, I finally got them there, Annie, they're there. So they're in the community and my dad had, I mean, he used to have a garden that was massive. And like, aww. I'm talking, he had a vegetable garden, the house garden, plus a half an acre out the back where he grew potato and kumara and all sorts of things. So he's now gone into this unit. He's got his little garden out the back where he grows like greens and lettuce and broccoli and stuff for him and mum. And he's now in the composting club.
Ooh.
Ooh, he's in the composting club, loving it. So it doesn't matter what scale it's on. And he's now got all his little buddies. Some of his buddies are still fishing. They're doing sort of swaps there. You know, there's ways.
He's probably teaching people, actually, do you think?
Yeah. I think so. He's really thoroughly enjoying it. So it's getting back to some of those skills that our parents and grandparents used to do and bring them back.
I think we have to take responsibility for our health. That's what it comes back down to. Is you are not taking responsibility for your health. If you have a condition or a diagnosis that you're, you know, not coping with and you're feeling that the answers lie outside yourself, the answers lie within. And first of all, it's making a decision that you are worth it. You are worth it to nurture. I meet people all the time that don't want to spend money on their health, but they have a flash new car or e-bike, or that is on their health, I suppose. But, you know, they might spend a lot of money on knitting wool. Sorry, Marie, but I'm also addicted to that. They might spend a lot of money on wool, but they balk at the idea of buying salmon for themselves. And I'm not saying we should all eat salmon each day, but you know what I mean. Let's swap some of the bad stuff out and put some good stuff in. Yeah. Let's look at, and with the whole thing with budgeting, I've met people that say they can't afford good food. So we've done a whole budget, and I know that's going a long way down a different track, but it actually helped them to see that, you know, I went to the supermarket yesterday for the first time in a month. That's how often I go to the supermarket. I hate going there. I do not enjoy it because of the lights and the hustle and the bustle and the fact that I've been banned from that particular one over the COVID era for sticking stickers on shelves telling people to go to the FF. I think it's just, you know, like I see people reach for the Olivani, right?
Yeah.
Reach for the butter. I see people reach for a package something, put the package back. And actually something that's worked for my daughter is she's been living with me. She should know how to cook, but no, she'd been a carb addicted teen. She got Nadia Lim's My Food Bag. Now I keep thinking, oh, that's really expensive, but actually she and her boyfriend have learned some recipes, not from me, from that. They've learned how to put stuff together to make it yummy. And the next step for them is to get off that and do it themselves. Yeah. So that's taught them heaps, to be fair.
Yeah. Oh, there's always a way. There's always a way.
But we have to take responsibility because our government is not going to look after us. We don't want to get to the stage where our government looks after all of our needs, because that's, you know, that's beyond socialism, communism. Our doctors sadly don't have the capacity to look after us unless we have someone like Reversal NZ. But even then, we need to take our own responsibility. Mm. This is our life. It's our body. It's our experience. We may only have one life. It's short. It's very short. The older I get, the shorter it's getting. And we have to take responsibility and decide where we're spending our money. And I think our health is more important than the newfangled pair of shoes or sunglasses.
Look, couldn't agree more. Now, look, if you need to listen to any of the content that Annie and I have done before, we've covered dating, we've covered debt, we've covered death. That got a tremendous amount of response. You need to go to the replays page, just pop in Annie Hart in the search. All of those previous interviews will come up. They're fantastic. And if you want to reach out to Annie, inbox@realitycheck.radio is our email, or 2057 is the text. We can help hook you up. As always, I love chatting to you. We could chat for forever, you and I.
We could talk about knitting.
Wait,
you do that all the time, Marie.
I know. I do that all the time. So look, thank you very much, Annie. It's always been so much fun to catch up.
Yeah,
and as awesome. I said, 2057 for the text or inbox@realitycheck.radio if you want to reach out. Take care. More great content here to come with Counterculture. Don't disappear.
Have a great day.
This is Counterculture with Marie Buskey. Wednesdays at 10 a.m. on Reality Check Radio.
Welcome back to Counterculture with Marie on Reality Check Radio. It is hard to avoid any news on the US election, which will take place next week between Vice President Kamala Harris and former President Donald Trump. It is an election that in many ways is more important than what transpires here at home. The leader of the US sets a stage for the Western Hemisphere in not only diplomacy, but industry, finance and culture. I've been keenly following American politics for more than 30 years, and I've never witnessed anything like I have in this campaign. So I thought I would give you all a primer into next week's event, and I've pulled together a compilation of recent interviews around the topic of the US election. First up is Cam Slater, political journalist and observer par excellence. And we did an interview several months ago as a US election 101, how their system works, polling, and what our predictions were at that time. At the time of recording, Biden had just dropped out of the race, Harris was the presumptive nominee, and RFK Jr. was still running as an independent. Here's what Cam had to say.
Let's start right back at the beginning in terms of how they pull the process together. Because they are a federalized system with states, mm-hmm. in their election, most people probably realize that they have two rounds of electorate. We're just going to look at Senate and the House of Representatives. You have states run by governors, then you also have representatives like MPs, the closest thing to our MPs, in the House of Representatives.
Each state is its own country. That's
it is its own country, yeah.
Texas is its own country. California is its own country. That's why it's called the United States of America, right? Mm. Because they are a bunch of countries that have joined together to form a super country.
At this current election, there is not only voting for the president, but there's also voting for a certain number of representatives and a certain number of Senate seats. For a president, I don't think people realise how little power the president actually has in reality in sort of cobbling together this group of 50 countries, as it were, together under those United States. They have executive powers and executive orders that can be rolled over and only can really stay in place as long as you're the executor. It's really down to what you can get through the House of Representatives and the Senate. Now, at the moment, that is split. You've got a House of Representatives, which is currently being held by the Republicans by the squeak of their teeth, and then the same thing in the Senate by the Democrats. That has the potential to roll over at this next election, as well as the Electoral College, mm-hmm. which is allocations of votes given to each state proportionally based on its size.
Yep.
And of all of those, with the exception of two, which I think are Maine and Nebraska, I've got a funny thing, is the other one, which do allocate their college seats proportionally, everybody else is a winner takes all.
Yep, that's right.
Yep.
So just in on the Electoral College, the way the Electoral College works, it is based largely on population. So the larger states have more electoral college votes. And the way it works is you get two votes per state that represents your senators, and then the rest is allocated on the number of representatives. So California is the largest. They have 54 electoral college votes. Texas is the next largest with 40, and Florida has 30. And there's some that have only got three.
Washington, D.C., for example.
Exactly. And, well, Washington, D.C. isn't technically a state, but they have given D.C. and D.C., you know, the District of Columbia does have some electoral college votes. There's a total of 538 electoral college votes, which is the name that Nate Silver created his polling company with, 538 he called it. And you need 270 to win. And that's the maths.
Yeah.
That you need.
You've heard two buzz terms. One is a bellwether state. So, Cam, explain to everybody what a bellwether state is.
It comes from farming, and a bellwether was the lead sheep, right? So the narrative is that we have bellwether electorates in New Zealand. Hamilton East is one of them. To put it into a New Zealand context, you've got bellwether states in the United States, and if they fall for one or other of the candidates, then it's likely that's heading in the right direction for that candidate to win the Electoral College.
Mm-hmm. The next one, of course, is either swing states or battleground states, is the new term that I'm hearing now, because obviously it's more, you know, clickbaity. So explain to everybody what those are.
Well, those are states where it could go either way. Like, there's some states that are never going to change. Right? It'd be a miracle. California is one of them, for example. It's always Democrat. And that is an electoral college head start for a Democrat candidate of 54 votes. But then you've got states like Georgia, Florida, some of the other states that give you an indicator. Sometimes it can even be places like New Hampshire, And even though New Hampshire's only got four electoral college votes, that top right-hand corner of the United States where New Hampshire, Vermont, Maryland, Connecticut, and bordering on to New York and New Jersey, where they are, that is quite a few little votes in a very small area. And if you can get, for example, one of the first states to fall there, then you can often see a march start to happen around all of those adjoining states. So you look at those battleground states where there is a fight, and if it falls for Biden, Biden was going to fall for Biden, it didn't at the last election, then you have a good chance of being able to predict that perhaps we're going to see a Democrat result here. And same for Trump. If he starts winning places like Florida and Georgia and if he wins New Jersey, that's huge, right? Because that's usually Democrat. So if he carries that state, that's one of those indicators, those battleground states that you're going to see a result.
In 2016, which for all intents and purposes, the mainstream legacy media, they had odds on Hillary in the bag for that election. Yep. What they hadn't anticipated was the resurgence in Wisconsin, Michigan, Pennsylvania, to a greater or lesser extent, that Trump won. And they just didn't see it coming, because when the votes came in earlier in the night, things were, you know, it was falling as they had predicted and expected.
Yeah, and because then New Jersey and New York and Delaware and Maryland and all, you know, Maine, they see all of those all falling for Clinton. And they think, okay, this is all good. But then you're right, in that Rust Belt, Wisconsin and all up there in the north, all of a sudden started falling for Trump. It was a disaster for them. They couldn't cope.
So this time around, pretty much the swing states or those battlegrounds haven't changed, with the exception of probably Florida. So Florida's one that in 2000, for anyone that remembers the great Chad incident of 2000, where they had these punch card type voting machines, it was race between Bush and Gore. It was literally won or lost on those Chads in Florida, was it not?
Yep, and it came down to a court case in the end. It didn't matter. But this election's somewhat different, you know.
It is.
Some of the states that will be interesting to watch will be how Nevada, Arizona, and Texas fall. And you might think, why are those three important? Well, Nevada borders up against California. California's going to go Democrat. But Nevada, that could be iffy, because there's a strong, long border there with Mexico. And the next state across, Arizona, exactly the same. It's got a border with Mexico, and it's got a massive problem at the border. And, of course, Texas with their border with Mexico. Massive immigration problems coming through that border. And those states sometimes go Democrat and a pretty strong Democrat, but the people in those states have had a gutsful of all the illegal immigration. And so you could see 56 electoral college votes in those three states. They fall for Trump.
And I haven't actually checked the numbers. I know at the midterms, when they divided up the congressional districts, California lost two or three congressional districts because so many people had left California and most of them had gone into Texas. And I think Texas might have picked up one or two.
That's
so.
Right.
Yeah, so there is also that dynamic as well, because that changes the makeup in the House. So therefore, if you're a president, there's a term called a lame duck president, which is when you're installed as president, but you don't control your party.
Or either House. In order to get your agenda and policy agenda through Congress and through the Senate requires really deft politics.
Well, we mentioned those swing states, those battleground states.
Mm.
And in this election, they will be primarily New Hampshire, Minnesota, Arizona, as you mentioned before, Nevada, Georgia, Virginia, Michigan, Nebraska, North Carolina, Maine, and Wisconsin, which is the newbie since 2016. And the biggest one of that, the big daddy of all of those, is Pennsylvania. I actually personally believe that this election literally is going to be won or lost on Pennsylvania. What are your thoughts?
Well, it's the state where Trump, they attempted to assassinate Trump. So there could be a bit of a blip in favor of Trump in Pennsylvania. Kamala Harris has got one potential candidate for her running mate, a guy called Shapiro, who's from Pennsylvania. She's from California, so she kind of has to have somebody from the East Coast. It's kind of how it works, male, female, black, white, West Coast, East Coast, you know, Rust Belt, you know, cities, all of those sorts of things come into play. And, of course, they're being Democrats. They've got all of the identitarian groups that they've got to try and assuage and manage. And, you know, it's bizarre because you've got Kamala Harris who's trying to go for what she calls the coconut vote, which is, you know, people from the West Indies, where her father is from. But her mother's actually Indian. So she's trying to play the black card, even though she's kind of not, if you know what I mean. So, yeah, Pennsylvania could come down to that one state.
And this is where the excitement and the dynamism comes in with the American system, right? Is that when you look at the conundrum she's got, does she go with pragmatism and select someone like Shapiro, who's in that key state, and he's Jewish, so then comes with all those wealthy Jewish dollars that that the Democratic Party rely on to stay afloat?
Yep.
Or does she have to concede to the rackety, noisy element of the Democratic Party, the activist wing of the Democratic Party, the Squad et al., who, of course, will hate Shapiro because he represents everything that they are opposed to, and will she select somebody that sits from that wing? But then they tend not to come with the dollars. They don't like to spend money, activists. They like to complain about everyone else having money and spending it, but they don't choose to spend it themselves. So it's a really interesting conundrum that the Democrats have painted themselves in a corner over, I think. So then that leads to the flip-flopping with the media and Kamala Harris. I mean, it's almost like they're trying to create the Jacinda effect that we had here in 2017.
Exactly what they're trying to do. And they've actually said it out loud that Kamala Harris is going to follow the footsteps of Jacinda Ardern. They've actually said that in US media. You know, this is a change shortly before the election. We'll see the same thing happen. Kamala Harris will come storming through. You know, there's the same level of intelligence too. They're both ninnies.
Right. So do you think post-COVID, where there have been so many gaslights and people from both sides of the aisle have started seeing it and gone, really? And the Americans have seen it more than most. And then they've seen the gaslighting over the border, you know, because let's face it, she was the border czar and then she wasn't the border czar, according to the media. Do you think that voters will look at this attempt to lionize her, to get her across the line as president, and then going, yeah, no. Or they will just fall into line on partisan lines like they always do.
Well, there's a certain number of the population that believe everything the mainstream media says. There's a whole lot more of us that are more awake now to see what's going on. And it's not just the media that are gaslighting US society. It's also the tech companies. So, you know, if people were searching for attempted assassination of TR and you put TR into Google, you didn't get any results for Trump. You got Truman, you got people with different names. So they were definitely putting their finger on the scale, the tech companies. Facebook's Meta was doing the same thing. They said, oh, it's a terrible mistake.
That's the unexpected consequence, though, of 2016, isn't it? I've written this down here, Cambridge Analytica.
Yeah.
Because Trump and his campaign used Cambridge Analytica to actually help get a reach via social media that had never been done before, and they targeted the key states that they needed to target in that disaffected Rust Belt vote to get them across the line. And then once that was realised, because, of course, let's face it, tech is renowned to being like Labour Party lovies here. They are overtly Democrat, and it was almost like they'd felt like they'd, you know, let their own side down. So do you think that this is tech's really perverted way of trying to redress what they did in 2016?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely, that's the case. You know, the most of the tech companies that exist in the United States are headquartered in California. You know, California is facetiously called the Socialist Republic of California. It's a state that is in decline. They've got more and more woke as they've gone by, but it's now a city, you know, most of the cities are overrun with beggars, street people, You've got massive poverty problems, and you've got people who are in, you know, in key industries, and a classic case of that is Elon Musk's corporations that have been formerly based in California. He's up, just picked those entire companies up and moved them to Texas.
Mm.
Right? He's saying, I can't do business with this state anymore. Their taxes are incredible, and the tech companies are all populated by, you know, weirdos and freaks that parading around dressed as donkeys or giraffes or whatever they've chosen to be their gender, and they're putting their finger on the scale. But people are aware of it. I mean, we're seeing now in real time, and we can thank Elon Musk for this, ironically, and say he's freed up Twitter or X as a platform, and so now people are getting their news from there because they don't trust the mainstream media anymore because they know they lie. They don't trust the tech companies because they know they lie, but they do know that Elon Musk stands up for free speech, that things aren't getting censored on X. And you can see real-time analysis happening from people like Tucker Carlson, who's got many, many, many millions more of an audience than he ever had at Fox News. Tech can be used both ways. I mean, they theoretically should be neutral, but they're not. Facebook especially and Google. They're putting the finger on the scale in the United States while keeping their money offshore. So can you trust them?
For listeners now who think, oh, okay, there's a lot more nuance going on there than just sort of people casting votes. Where do you think, so what are you seeing? I'm seeing Pennsylvania. What are you looking at? And what will you be keeping your eye on? What are your predictions?
You know, a lot of people discount the polls. They say, oh, no, they lie. But they give you an indication, right? So I have a number of places that I go to look to get information. On my website, The Good Oil, I have a newsletter each day, weekday, that goes out that I send to my, you know, VIP customers. And I send them a selection of information that's across the political spectrum. So I look at websites like The Liberal Patriot, strong democratic focus, but they're sane. Again, that's on Substack. Search The Liberal Patriot, you'll find it. In terms of polling, there's a couple of sites I look at. First one is Real Clear Politics. They're neither left nor right, and they're essentially an aggregator site, but they collate polls and run what they call the RCP averages, and that gives you an indication there as well. But the main person I follow is Nate Silver. He's got a track record. The guy is an absolute genius. His full-time job is actually playing poker professionally. So he understands odds and betting and all of those sorts of things. He started off doing statistics for baseball and football. And then he thought, well, hang on, I can build a model for politics. And then he got into political prediction modeling and things like that. So whilst he's running models, he's usually based on reality. And he used to work for 538. And he left 538 because they were putting their finger on the scale when it came to the models. And he was against that. So he left and he set it up as he's gone out on his own again. And he's, you know, built a new election model. You know, last week on Friday, he changed from the presidential election as Trump's to lose to being a toss up, because that's what he's seen in the space of a week.
Mm.
That the polling is changing, which is affecting the modelling. But again, he puts an asterisk on that and says, until Kamala Harris is the actual nominee, then it's moot. It's, yes, it's a rolling feast. But he's worth watching because he explains in easy-to-understand language how his models work.
That was Cam Slater from The Good Oil, and as discussed, the fundamentals of the US election coming up, and you know Cam, he will be watching this election like an absolute hawk over the coming days. Next up is Trevor Loudon. Trevor is a Florida-based Kiwi writer and political commentator, specialising in communism and modern politics. Here's a grab from our latest conversation a month or so ago after Kamala had been given the nomination, but just before RFK joined the Trump campaign. Good morning and welcome back to Counterculture, here with Marie. Joining me now, all the way from Florida, Trevor Loudon, commentator, writer, and of course, great friend of the show. How are you, Trevor?
I'm great, Marie. Thanks for having me on, and regards to all the listeners.
It's so good to have you back in, what are we, 40-ish days out from fun and games? Have you got your popcorn ready, the cold beverages in the esky? Are you ready to go for the 5th of November?
Well, I think more people are worried about not so much popcorn, but ammunition and food supplies and generators and things to, you know, to survive a period of turmoil. I think that's what more of us are, well, more people I know are focused on that than popcorn, I'll tell you.
Yeah. Do you, I mean, is there actually a genuine concern amongst conservatives that there will be a Democratic backlash if Donald Trump were to win?
Oh, very much so. A lot of us are expecting violence on the street this month. If not, when Trump wins, we definitely expect violence and disruption and chaos and everything from legal stuff to street riots to just the Democrats going about election deniers. You wait and see who the real election deniers are if Trump wins this. They'll be doing every legal maneuver, every trick in the book you can imagine. And that will just, you know, people are already wound up now. They're just going to provoke people like crazy.
Well, it's funny you should mention that, because I know what I'm getting just from down here and looking at all of this going on is I can't help but getting a bit of deja vu, a whiff of 2016 about the whole election race. Do you feel that?
Yeah, I think so. You know, this is, you know, it was Trump versus Hillary, Trump versus Kamala. This is going the same way again. Everybody's on 10. It's just that the ante has been upped, but it's very much a similar dynamic. And so we've had a lot of shenanigans between, you know, Hillary's time and now, and a lot of people have come to understand the depth of corruption in the government way beyond what they understood when Hillary was running. And this is widespread now. You don't get a lot of pushback when you talk about this kind of thing, even in just moderate audiences.
Now, I'm really intrigued that you've mentioned moderate audiences, because as the whole campaign has now started to unfold, you've had the palace coup and Kamala has been installed. With Robert F. Kennedy Jr. sort of kind of doing an endorsement of Trump, like he's dropped out of the race, where does an undecided voter go, Trevor, and what does an undecided voter look like right now?
Look, I think there are, if you're an undecided voter now, you're paying no attention and probably won't vote. I would guess the undecided voter is way less than 2 or 3% now. You know,
really?
You've made up your mind now, you're going to vote Democrat or you're going to vote Green or you're going to vote Republican for Trump. The days of the old swing voter are long gone, I think. Every election it gets tighter, less and less undecideds. So this is a much more polarized electorate now. The undecided swing voter probably isn't going to vote. You haven't made up your mind by now, you're not going to vote.
Because I do wonder whether or not, because in the United Kingdom, for example, you had reform come in as a spoiler, but what they didn't predict was the exceptionally poor turnout, and actually the most powerful voting bloc was the one that stayed at home and didn't
absolutely.
Go out at all. So will
like, Labour got a landslide, but they got less votes than they did last time.
Exactly.
Because the vote was so down, especially for the Conservatives, well-deservedly so, that Labour just with a split vote and everything, Labour just got a landslide with a pathetic vote.
So what sort of danger then do you have, and who would be most at risk by this, for that apathetic voter, that one that really isn't tapped in, isn't interested, and are so disengaged with everything that they also are so disengaged that they won't even go out and vote? That voter bloc, who will that impact more, the Republicans or the Democrats?
I think it will impact the Republicans more, because a large proportion of the American Christian vote is in that camp. A large proportion. You know, less than 50% of Christians in America are registered to vote, and about half of those actually do vote. If they voted, and even normal proportions, and they tended to vote conservative, Republicans went hands down every time. But yeah, it's there's been a real program to try and get Christians to stay home this time. The Democrats are really focused on that, and some of your more naive pastors have bought into it. you know, President Trump's not really the most godly man that they want on earth. And so therefore it's better to have a communist, you know, to teach people a lesson.
Oh, the irony. You know,
seriously.
Really?
That's what they think. And if we lose, and I think the Republicans will win. I think Trump will win at least the election. But what happens after that is different. I think he will win. But if he loses, it will be because of the lazy Christians and cowardly Christians who put a virtuous veneer on their cowardice and irresponsibility. That's how I'm going to say it.
I had a question here, but you've actually pretty much answered it. I said Kamala, is she a Marxist or a moron or all of the above? And I think we've covered off definitely Marxist.
Because he's a Marxist with moronic tendencies.
You know, you like to research and scratch below the surface. She's not come to this as a first generation, well, this is a wonderful new idea that I learned in college.
No.
This is ingrained in her, is it not?
Look, I've got a book coming out in a few days. It's called Stealth, Kamala Harris's Communist Roots. And it's going to be available worldwide on Amazon. If you ever meet a communist in life, and not most people haven't, they become communists in university. They get some Marxist professors, they get all fired up about Palestine or something, and they become communists. She was a communist from the cradle. She's never been anything but a communist. She was going to a communist social club in elementary school, primary school, called the Rainbow Dream. They had Marxist poets every Thursday night, you know. Her father was an affirmative action Marxist. Stanford University didn't have enough Marxists in its economics department at the time, so they recruited the best Marxist they could find. They mounted a campaign to recruit the best Marxist, and her mother, Shyamala Gopalan, is a hardcore Marxist as well. Both were part of a group called the Afro-American Association, which was the group that spawned the Black Panther Party, which a lot of people don't understand. That was a pro-China, pro-North Korea, Marxist, Maoist group. People think it's just a black nationalist group. No, it was Maoist. And her parents were part of the group that sprang from. She has been involved with Marxists since she was 6 months old to now. The Maoists who came to the movement in the 60s and who are now running the Democratic Party and a lot of Hollywood and most of the labor unions and that sort of thing in America, that's her people. Street-level Maoists, Maoists who went into business, Maoists who went into the leadership of the Democratic Party. She is completely part of that movement. She would be nothing without that movement, nothing at all.
She is someone who has appeared to have fallen upwards and certainly slipped away to political ascendancy. So being tapped in, Trevor, as I know you are, to, you know, the whole social element of the world, the whole diddy-diddy-dum-dum situation, and she was pretty tight with the didda back in the day, will this stick to her like they tried to stick Epstein with Trump, or is currently the Hollywood and media elite running for cover with this whole P. Diddy scheme?
Yeah, well, see, you know, they tried to hang Epstein around Trump's neck because that's the left-wing narrative and they'll drive that. No, I think she'll be pretty much insulated from this. You know, there won't be any court cases till after the election. She'll be protected. The media is protecting her every step of the way. So they won't let something like that be hung around her neck. Some of the people around her are the most corrupt and vile people you could possibly imagine, you know, the Podestas and types like that. But it's not going to be allowed to do it unless Trump makes a big issue of it somehow. But I think they'd be scared of the backlash amongst women voters. I don't think they will go there on that. But Trump's full of surprises, you never know. But I don't think it would be a very profitable way to go. There's more than enough to concentrate on her connections and her policies to scare the hell out of people if you're really focusing on them.
Which is what was so disappointing about the debate. Like, she was obviously prepared within an inch of her life. There was sort of hints of collusion between moderators and the questions and how they handled, you know, thank you, Madam Vice President, too. We need to move on to the next question, Mr. Trump, you know, like that, and in terms of how they handled it. they were very clever, whoever prepared, because she obviously didn't do it, they were very, very clever in their preparation to bait bear traps that they knew Donald Trump would fall into, and he did.
Yeah,
because policy
was Trump's finest moment at all. He was not prepared, because I think he'd had such an easy time with Biden, and I think he believed, you know, believed Kamala was pretty stupid, but he's got to understand that the people around her are very skilled operatives, and they baited traps for him, and a whole bunch of things he could have hammered her on, he just walked right past, because she got him a bit rattled. He just looked grumpy through the whole thing, not as usually smiling self, and that's his fault, you know, he's to blame for that. She's not going to appear at the Al Smith dinner, which is a traditional roast type dinner. It's a charity dinner that every Republican and Democrat candidate attends it. She's not going to appear at that, because she knows that's more ad lib. That's more to and fro. She couldn't be prepared very well for that. That's the dinner. A few years ago, a friend of mine, Evan Sayat, wrote the lines for Trump. He said, his joke was, I bumped into Hillary Clinton on the stairway. She said, pardon me. I said, I might. that was the Al Smith dinner in 2016, I believe.
That was Trevor Loudon. And as Trevor mentioned, his new book on Kamala Harris is out now, called Stealth, Kamala Harris's Communist Roots. Up next is Kevin Sorbo, conservative Christian actor and producer, and best known here as Hercules. Whilst much of our conversation was on entertainment, I know Kevin keeps a very keen eye on politics, so I just couldn't help myself and I had to get his take on the upcoming election. Here's what he had to say. Are you seeing a pivot now? I mean, look, we are now into October. Next month, the big show is on. Yeah. Are you seeing a pivot in the mood from 2016 to 2020 to 2024? What have you seen?
People are there is a tipping point. There's no question. People are starting to wake up. Lions are starting to wake up. The sheep are going to be the sheep. But more and more people are vocalizing. Because the last 4 years of this government, which is a total hardcore socialist government, to let 20 million people, what is the population of New Zealand? 5 million?
Five and a half million.
We let 20 million people in this country come across the border. In the 4 years Trump was in office, it was below 4 million for the whole 4 years. This is five times as many people. They've already estimated 800,000 of these people are terrorists. They admit to the fact that they're now in America. I think we're going to have a 9/11 scale in every city sometime in the next 2 to 5 years. They're planning. They're very patient about it. We're going to have something horrific happen to this country because of these people coming in. The amount of people getting attacked, raped, murdered from illegals, 475,000 reported attacks already. 475,000. What we're doing to this country is on beyond evil, what our government's doing. And it seems to be, obviously, it's on purpose. And you're looking at Kamala Harris, who wasn't, when she ran for office 4 years ago, she had she didn't get one vote, didn't win one delegate. She didn't even make it to Iowa. She was the first of the 13 people running for the president's office against Trump in 2020. She didn't even make it to Iowa. She was the first voted off by people in the Democrat Party. And what I find even more hilarious is to me is that her only qualification is to be vice president. And these are Joe Biden's words. They're not mine. He said, my running mate will be a woman of color. That was her qualifications to be a woman of color. And how she got to be now the nomination, and they're painting her as this amazing person. And when we were in California, people knew about her. They called her Casting Couch Kamala because she's pretty much sleeping with everybody to work her way up the San Francisco and Sacramento political chain. So here we are. And this just proves that anybody can be president in America. That's what it proves.
When you're talking to people that you know, I mean, surely there must be those even more centrist liberals that are looking at this going with raised eyebrows, wondering what on earth is going on.
Oh yeah, there's no question about that. I mean, I know. Look, I still got liberal friends. We get along just fine. We don't harbor hate towards each other. We give each other a hard time, but it's all, you know, guys giving each other a hard time. I sit there and watch what's going on within our political system right now. What's going on with in terms of just the backlash? Look, when I meet people that disagree with me and I say, well, what policies of President Trump during his 4 years did you not like? And they go, well, he's a jerk. He's an asshole. And I go, well, those aren't policies. OK, and they're running on that. And the truth is, before he announced himself as a Republican candidate, he was a registered Democrat. And everybody wanted him on their late night talk shows. They all, well, Hollywood, please do a cameo on my TV show or my movie. They all loved the guy. The minute he went down that road, they just went after him, just vilified the guy. And I love they call him a Nazi. Number one, Nazi stands for National Socialist. He's hardly a National Socialist to begin with. And they use that Nazi term so freely, it doesn't make any sense. But if you ask people, be honest now, were you better off during those 4 years than you've been the last 4 years? And if they are honest, of course they were. We were energy independent. We were doing our own oil. This whole climate hustle, climate warming thing it's ridiculous to me. The trillions of dollars we're throwing out there. Do you think India or China care about what they're doing in terms of pollution? Our country now, our world right now is in dire need of not to get less carbon. We need more carbon. I saw a 450-year pattern that supposedly came out from whatever they're studying, the scientists. And we're at one of the lowest peaks we've ever been right now. So to me, that's a whole other issue we can talk about. But I just think it's ridiculous. I call climate change weather. That's what it is. They're called seasons, kind of what it is. Just 10 years ago, they thought we were going to have another ice age here in America because we had the coldest decade in like since the 1970s. So I just find it sad, this whole power and control thing happening, and people afraid. Once Biden got in office, he took away our resources of drilling oil. Well, what do? We buy oil from the Middle East. So we fund our own wars against ourselves. That's what we're doing. Yeah. We're paying countries that hate us to have oil when we got so much oil in America and up in Alaska, which is part of America, but there's so much untapped oil up there. And these people that want to get rid of oil, then maybe they need to start living the lifestyle, getting rid of their iPhones, getting rid of the computers, getting rid of a lot of their clothes, getting rid of the toothbrush, hairbrush, vacuum cleaner. There's oil in all these products. I think people are so ignorant that what oil is being used for.
Now, not everyone I've spoken to is fully on board with the Trump train. Anne Marie Waters, lawyer, activist, and political candidate, sees the upcoming US election through a feminist lens. This is Anne Marie's thoughts on the upcoming election.
Just speaking of women, we are getting it from all sides. I mean, from the right, you're right. And they're becoming, I think the Overton window has shifted a little bit on the right for misogynistic men on the right. They're now saying things they wouldn't have said a few years ago. Women shouldn't do this and women shouldn't do that. They're going to be brazen about it. So we've got that on the right. And by the way, I'll make a little prediction for you. If Kamala Harris wins in November, if she wins, I don't like Donald Trump. I actually probably prefer her over him, frankly. But if she wins in November, and I think that she will, if she wins in November, remember I told you this, right-wing men will start saying women shouldn't be allowed to vote. And they'll be serious. And I'll be interested to see who joins in that chorus. I will be very interested to see. Because I think if she wins, and I think that she will, I think it will be women's vote that does it for her, that gets her over the line. So wait for it. Wait for it. That will come.
Finally, I bring you James Fishback. James is the founder of Incubate Debate, and he is also an economist and financial analyst. I asked him about the financial impacts riding on the outcome of the US election, and here are some of his thoughts.
How important are these elections for actually setting the global tone for the financial stability, particularly in the Western Hemisphere? Do you have concerns?
I have huge concerns. You know, most elections, to tell you the truth, they don't matter. Most elections don't matter. Bush versus Gore. There's a corporate tax rate angle, right? Romney versus Obama. Well, there's a regulation angle. This is a great reset election. Do we want to double down on the stupid policies of the past 4 years that have given us record inflation, that have given us record migration, that have spiked crime, that have contributed to the sense of helplessness and disaffection in all swaths of America? Or do we want to go back to the policies of Donald Trump, the proven track record, that worked. And by the way, you may not like his tweets. You may not like the way he said things publicly. But what is an undeniable fact is that we didn't enter any new wars. We saw low inflation. And at the end of the day, prosperity was shared widely. We have never been this divided as a country since the Civil War. And I actually had, you know, when President Biden was sworn in, I'll never forget January 20th, I actually had hope that I didn't vote for him. I don't support his policies. But I actually thought that if there was one thing he could do coming out of this pandemic and the awful response to it, was I thought he could unify the country. I didn't think he was going to lean into the rhetoric that he did, calling people who voted for Donald Trump MAGA Republicans and a threat to democracy and to divide the country as much as he did. This is a great reset election. Do we want to continue down the path where we jeopardize our national security by bringing in 10,000 migrants who are unvetted every single day, who suck on resources, who are competing with American citizens for housing, and that's a very scarce resource, who in many ways, by the way, are actually being exploited by large multinational businesses who want cheap labor but don't want to pay Americans, don't want to actually have to stare down the communities that are consumers of their products and services and say, we know that you're struggling. We know that you are faced with many issues that may have left you to leave the labor force. You may be long-term unemployed. We don't want to pay to get you back on your feet and work to retrain you. We'd rather have cheap labor from Honduras and Senegal that's coming across the border. We'd rather pay them to do it. And so this is a referendum, not just on Kamala Harris and Donald Trump and conservative and liberal policy. It's a referendum on the social contract itself. To whom is the U.S. president accountable? To the American citizens or to the people who got shipped here 2 weeks ago and are now demanding tens of thousands of dollars in taxpayer-paid benefits?
In terms of the issues, there's a lot of bread and circuses. So I think the latest bread circus at the time that we're talking is about, I think, Haitians eating cats. There is a lot of crazy noise. What are for you, the top three issues that are not necessarily getting the airplay that they should because it will expose it's sort of a rotten carcass of what's been going on in the last 4 years? If you were a policy advisor to Donald Trump, what would be the three things that you would say, Mr. Trump, you need to concentrate on these things and forget everything else?
You have to talk about the border. You have to talk about inflation. And you have to talk about war, global conflict. Let's talk about just inflation for one moment. It's in the middle there, but let's talk about that. You know, I went to school for economics. That was my undergraduate study, was economics. And the economic definition of inflation is the change in price level year over year. So if you go to Walmart, we go to some hypermarket, right, in New Zealand, and we spend $100 on groceries in year one. And then in year two, it's $170. And then in year three, it's still $170. Inflation in year one was 70%. Inflation in year two was 0%. That is the economic, technical definition of inflation. But the way most people think about inflation, and rightly so, is, am I paying more for the same stuff today than I was a year ago, than I was 4 years ago? And to that question, the answer is unequivocally yes. Things across the board in America are 25 to 30% more expensive. And so what Kamala Harris wants to say is that, well, actually, inflation has slowed and it's not as bad as it could have been and it's not as bad as it was. The reality is things are more expensive today than they were under Donald Trump. And I would drive that point home. I would talk about the border, which, by the way, is an issue that unites a multi-ethnic coalition of voters. It is Black and Hispanic voters, citizens of this country who can trace their lineage back generations, who stand to lose the most from an influx of cheap labor. This is a fact. I mean, I know Donald Trump got a lot of flack for it, saying they're going to take Black jobs. Well, let's just look at the facts. Black workers disproportionately work in leisure hospitality. They disproportionately work in restaurants. And so when you bring in cheap labor into restaurants, into leisure and hospitality, into hotel settings, you are pushing out Black workers who are citizens, who have paid their taxes, who have children that they're raising in these communities, have called America home for distant generations. That is wrong. That is un-American. And that is not just insulting to those who voted for Donald Trump this election or the past one. That is insulting to everyone, Republican, Democrat, Independent. I think 90% of voters would be rightly furious by, are rightly furious by what's happening at the southern border. And so if I'm Donald Trump, I'm talking about the economy, I'm talking about inflation, and I'm talking about the border. Those are the issues that, one, are the most real for voters, the most wide-reaching for voters, and that both Democrats and Republicans care about them. And third, are issues that Kamala Harris has specifically failed on. President Biden made her the border czar. New York Times said it at the time. Axios said it at the time. And once again, they're trying to rewrite history with their unabashed gaslighting. And so she was put in charge of the southern border. She accepts that. And it's time to look at her track record. It is awful.
I hope you really enjoyed my roundup of recent guests with their thoughts on next week's US election. You can hear more on RCR with the Political Agenda on Friday morning, and we'll take a look at how the election is tracking just a handful of days out. This election is significant for us on so many levels. I can't emphasise that enough. Political, cultural, financial, and as is often says, if the US sneezes, we catch cold. I believe we have had a COVID-sized case of the flu with the current administration, so I personally will be watching this result very, very closely. If you've got any comments about what you've just heard this morning, drop us a line. 2057 is the text number, or inbox at realitycheck.radio is the email.
You're listening to Counterculture on RCR.
Reality Check Radio.
You're here with Marie on Counterculture, and of course you're with Reality Chook, I mean Check Radio. I just want to thank everyone who sent in feedback yesterday on Alistair Harding's incredible interview with my husband Phil, aka Mr. Marie, for the special inquiry session. Your feedback was so humbling for both of us, and stay tuned with Media Matters as I'll give you updates over there if we choose to take things further. If you missed Alistair's interview, it's available now as a replay in the app or at realitycheck.radio. Hey, a quick reminder from the RCR merch team to the Foundation members. Make sure you check your inboxes for the massive summer sale discount coupon for all merch in time, not only for the warmer weather, but festive gift giving as well. Didn't you get yours? Then drop the inbox team a line by texting 2057 or emailing inbox@realitycheck.radio. Hey, Natalie Cutler-Welch is waiting in the wings with Up Your Brave. And before I hand you over to Nat, I'll be back again here tomorrow with Marty Gibson for Media Matters. Catch us live from 1 p.m. And I'll leave you now with some more country music. Here is Kaylee Bell with Take It to the Highway here on RCR. Have a great day, and I'll catch you all tomorrow.
You've been listening to Counterculture
with Marie Buskey
on RCR.
Reality Check Radio.